to Le Bush Le Bebes.
Well, hello, Roxette.
Hi, Rachel.
How are you doing?
Honestly, I'm very anxious today. I'm not going to lie. Not having a great day, but it's okay. We're here. We showed up.
Yeah, you're pushing through, and I'm really happy
for
you and proud of you for doing that.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm fucking chilling.
Guess what song I'm thinking about? What?
1, 2, 3, yeah. My baby don't mess around because she loves me so, and that's a no for sure.
That's a good one.
Yeah, it's a classic.
I don't have one in my head today.
Okay.
My head's empty for songs today. But I'm very excited to talk about this topic.
Yeah. Well, today is all about radical self-acceptance and understanding the difference between body positivity, body neutrality, and self-acceptance.
Yeah.
And what those things mean. Because body positivity was definitely a really, I guess, hyped up buzzword.
Mm-hmm. Like, really, it had a big moment. Yeah.
And now I think, because body positivity is all about, you know, accepting and loving your body and celebrating your body, essentially. That's what it's all about. Versus body neutrality is about, I don't have to love it, I don't have to hate it. It is what it is. It doesn't define me. I am so much more than that. It's like minimizing the focus on the body itself, which I think might be a little more realistic when it comes to struggling with issues of, you know, body dysmorphia, how you view yourself, body confidence, etc. Is just, I don't need to be hot, I don't need to be ugly, I just need to be, you know? And just as a definition, before we dive deeper into this, I wanted to cover more definitions. Radical self-acceptance is similar to body neutrality, but it's the opposite of avoiding responsibility or giving up in self-defeat.
So all three of these things, body neutrality, body positivity, radical self-acceptance, I feel like they're frames of mind and tools that you can use internally when you're feeling, you know, some sort of way, as many of us do. And radical self-acceptance, I think, starts to go into the more emotional side of things a little bit more versus just solely the physical side of things, which I think is an interesting aspect of all three definitions.
I think radical self-acceptance for sure is one of those spaces where it diminishes the importance of how you look. And in some of our other episodes, we talk about how there was a shift in the early 1900s where there was less of a focus on femininity being on moral values and character and more about body. And so now we're seeing some of the unlearning of that, you know, with some of these terms that we're describing. Yeah, we have a great speaker coming on later.
So excited for you guys to hear from her.
Ms. Paulina Pinsky. She is a very accomplished and published writer. She has some work in the Huffington Post, and she has a book out called It Doesn't Have to Be Awkward, where she is co-written and published with her father, Dr. Drew Pinsky. And we're really going to dive deeper into, you know, her experience with body dysmorphia, how it relates to her background in figure skating and her family, and where she's at today working through all of these different modes of recovery. So we're really excited to have her on.
Absolutely. I think she was one of the guests that both you and I were so drawn to from the beginning when we were conceptualizing this podcast because of her personal experience and story and the way she's shared that with her audience, which I think is very special. And you guys will hear, it's amazing. It's a great interview. So we're really, really enthralled with that.
Cool. Well, let's get started. I guess, Roxette, I know you have a lot of experience. Maybe not necessarily struggling with, but coming to terms with body neutrality and radical self-acceptance. And I think when we, at the genesis of this entire show, you felt, or at least you seemed to be so drawn to specifically radical self-acceptance and trying to integrate that more into your life. So I wanted to understand what your journey with that has been so far.
I guess on the idea of radical self-acceptance, that's been such a difficult place for me to come to. And I think I finally am coming to a place where, like, I am more accepting of my physicality. But I don't remember a time past the last 2 years that I have ever looked in the mirror and said to myself, like, I love you, or, you know, whatever, like, been happy with my image, if you will. And I think figure skating, as we've talked about a little bit, but obviously want to dive deeper into, did create this, like, toxic mentality because you are so judged on the physicality as well as your ability. And being put in that, I remember as young as, you know, we'll get into this a little bit more during the interview with Paulina, but I remember as young as 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old, being really ingrained with the idea that my body was not good enough and that I had to really, really work for this worth. And my body fully became my worth. So then moving from the figure skating world into the vibe of the influencer lifestyle was really detrimental to my mental health. And emotionally, it caused me to be so distraught, which was something that I already struggled with, but this just made it a more intense struggle. So that anytime I left the house, it was like a comparison of what others were looking like, wearing this and that. And it gets so deep. And I've talked to you about this a lot in, like, just our personal conversations about the dominoes, like these emotional dominoes that I feel really play into all these different aspects of mental health and how we look at ourselves and how we perceive not only our physical selves, but our emotional selves.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think everyone at a certain point has days or periods of time where they look at themselves in the mirror and might not be happy with what they see, but trying to, I guess, separate that as, like, this doesn't define me, and hey, maybe I've gained weight, but that doesn't change who I am as a person, that doesn't make my worth any less, you know? And it's so hard because even when it comes to dating and social media and all these things, we're constantly reminded of ways we can be better physically. Because it's all pictures, but that's just one of the many facets of every human being that's on this earth, you know? So it's definitely a tough subject to grapple with, but I'm really proud of all the work that you've been doing so far to work on that for yourself and unlearn some of those things that are so ingrained in almost all of our minds, you know?
Yeah.
Because when those thoughts take over and are really loud, they can take over your entire, like, personality or even your entire day, you know? So it's great that, like, you're still showing up for yourself and you're still doing all these things for you to make sure that, you know, you're putting in the work. Because, like, when we talk with Paulina later, like, it's not a cut and dry journey. It's not like one day you're going to have epiphany and every problem is going to go away. You know, it's up and down, up and down.
And that's, like, what we, I think, as human beings think is going to happen all the time. It's like we've been stuck in whatever it is, whatever obstacle or situation. And then all of a sudden it's like, no, we're good. But that's just not how it works. So it's okay. It's like these are works in progress for a lot of us. So if you're out there and if you're struggling with your image, you know, just know that you're not alone, because so many of us feel this way, especially in today's day and age. Like you were saying, it's like so accessible to look and see this image of perfection that is unattainable and that we should not be comparing ourselves to, but that we do. And, like, I think in my situation, a lot of people, like, when I've met some followers and subscribers in real life, like, people have this image of me that I'm this really confident, like, badass person that, like, so is, like, loves my body and loves this. And I think for a long time I talked about it online like that, because that was that it was almost like the my online persona had faked confidence until she made it. And when she made it, she was like, who the fuck is Roxette? And that's kind of where I am right now, where I'm, like, refiguring out who I am, not only from a physical sense but also from that emotional sense, after years of dealing with, you know, a lot of these self-deprecating thoughts.
So what are the main things that you're working on right now?
So one of the things that has helped me a lot over the last 6 months is replacing those self-deprecating thoughts with a positive one, so that the negative thoughts do not pass through my subconscious, so I cannot continue to work them into the way my neuropathways like actually process my emotions and my thoughts, which is a very scientific way to just say reverting your internal emotions to try to reflect a positive aspect of yourself. So for example, for me, when I would look in the mirror, a lot of times I would look at my legs, and my legs were like the biggest thing for me that I felt self-conscious about. I felt like I had thunder thighs. That's what would always tell me when I was growing up, not in those exact words, but she would always really pick me apart physically. Especially my legs, because figure skaters have big legs and big butts. And like my mom wanted me to be really slender. So now when I look at myself in the mirror, when I feel a thought coming into my head that's purely just judgmental towards myself, purely just negative towards a physical aspect of myself, I literally stop that thought to my best ability. It doesn't always work every day, but I try to stop that thought and then turn it around, and I'll say, you know what, Rox? I love your body. I love your legs. Your legs are strong. Your legs are able to do what you need them to do. You love going on walks. Awesome. That's your legs. So for me, that's really helped with just like my own self-talk, because I think negative self-talk is, again, one of those domino pieces that leads you down a really dark hole of looking at your body in a negative light.
And I think that I've experienced that as well, even, you know, it's hard not to have experienced at least some of this with the constant bombarding of social media. Mm. It's just crazy how social media has influenced and even changed like what bodies are considered attractive so much more quickly. These micro trends are shifting ever so quickly because of social media, you know, like in the 90s being Anna essentially was in style, like being a size 0 or double 0 was considered stylish, and then the Kardashians, I guess, popularized almost like appropriating black female bodies and black culture by promoting this BBL, you know, slim, thick, quote unquote, body. And even now it's going back to, you know, hyper skinny. And not maybe not necessarily hyper skinny, but it's shifting again, and who knows where it's gonna go. And that's definitely a follow up for our next episode that we talk about. This is talking more about like where is this going, and hopefully everyone is, you know, becoming a bit more conscious about these influences on marketing and social media that people can decide for themselves of what they want.
It's really interesting because now that we're talking about this, I feel like media in general has always played a role in like how we as the general public, if you want to call it that, like look up to the people that have this stardom or fame or celebrity status. So like in the 90s, when you think about like Kate Moss, you know, all these models, that the 90s were the model moment, right? Like that was the moment when like supermodels kind of became a thing in the 90s. And then it was like, that was the epitome of the female figure, right? And then in the 2000s, it was like Nicole Richie, Paris Hilton, which kind of still stuck on that same trend, but then moved into what we now see as the ideal, or a lot of people see as the ideal body type, which is that like very curvaceous, like blah, blah, blah. And I think even that, like Kim Kardashian has lost a bunch of weight and like is said to have, speculated to have removed some of her butt, whatever. And like,
yeah, I think, obviously, I am not anti plastic surgery. I think if you want to do it, you have bodily autonomy. You can do whatever you want. I just think that diving into like why you want your body to look a certain way can be a more productive conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we both believe that like every human has the right to choose what they want to do with their body, right? Whether it is plastic surgery or any kind of surgery or working out or not working out or whatever it may be. You have the choice to choose and that is only your choice. So, but the thing that makes it toxic, I think, in a lot of people's the mindsets, I guess you could say, and even my own in some ways, is that comparison factor, because it does give you the ability and the accessibility to change your looks to the
way that you think you're comparing yourself so that you feel like you look like that person. Whereas I think TikTok actually has brought in a lot of individuality, which I think is a really good place for media to be like weaning into in all these regards.
Yeah, and I think a really great addition to that is you can do whatever you want with your body. It's your choice. And questioning the institutions that made you, that might make you think you're not mm-hmm. worthy, that's what we really want to dive right. into and focus on right. on this episode, you know? Well, I think, Rox, as far as your, like, history with ice skating and body dysmorphia, I'm just surprised to hear about, like, when you first told me about a lot of these things, and I guess it is more common now that, like, all these other different types of sports are coming out with the stories with regard to this, but it's so almost, sounds like the antithesis of what training for a sport really is. Like, if you are intensely training to be an Olympic athlete, you should be, in my mind at least, at the peak of your health. And so the fact that you have stories of these coaches telling you, like, you need to be skinnier, you need to be this, and, like, that's what their idea of health was, when that's obviously wrong, is so crazy, you know?
Yeah, I think it's... figure skating is such an interesting world because it is partly artistic and partly, like, the physical aspect of the sport, but there is that, like...
aesthetic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So for me, like, my coaching experiences predominantly were not based on my health as an athlete. They were based on how my body would be perceived in my sport, because that's the physical aspect of what I was going to be judged on. And I think that's why I have it now so ingrained in my head, that this toxic thought about my body and the comparison, because of that feeling of, like, genuinely, like, you're gonna be judged, so get ready for that.
Yeah.
All right, so that's a little gist of what this episode is gonna be about. So yeah, let's welcome Paulina.
Yeah, can't wait. Well, hello, Paulina.
Hello.
Paulina.
Dead bush baby.
Paulina is officially a bush baby. We're so excited to have you on today.
I am literally a bush baby.
I know. I wanted to do a quick intro of Paulina, I guess, before we get started. Yeah. Roxette and I, as we've mentioned in past episodes, that we grew up figure skating, and we grew up figure skating with Paulina as well. She was part of that crazy world. Now Paulina is a published writer. She has a couple books out. She has a couple articles in the Huffington Post. Specifically, one of the ones called What Happened When I Told My Mom I Had an Eating Disorder. It really is a great read. It's so well written, very conversational. And How to Learn About Sex When Your Famous Sex Advice Father Teaches You Nothing. Which is a great title,
Hearing
honestly.
Hearing you say that title to me out loud is the funniest thing in the world. I didn't pick that title, by the way.
Like, really?
It's a good title.
They published it, and I was like, we're not wrong.
Yeah, we're so excited to have Paulina on, because not only are you know, obviously our childhood comrade. Wait, what is that word? I don't even know.
Comrade?
Yeah. Love that.
Comrade.
Yeah, figure skating comrade back in the day. Guys, it's early, okay? We all just got here. We're getting our voices going.
I love the idea of us being comrades.
We're comrades. We're definitely comrades. But also just such a credible opinion and so many personal experiences that kind of tie into the topics that we're going to be talking about today. So really excited to have this conversation with you.
Thank you, guys. Beautiful. Yeah, thank you for that wonderful intro. It's interesting, though, because I repressed ice skating for like the past 11 years. Like, I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't think about it. And then in sobriety, my coach Erica, like, literally was like, come skate. And I was like, okay. And I went on a public session and I could do nothing.
Oh my
and it
gosh.
Was so humbling. I was like, oh my God, like, I did take 11 years off. Like, what am I talking about? Like, why did I think I was going to be able to do an axle, you know? Like, it was a good, like, jumping the hurdle. And part of that is because, like, ice skating became like an unyielding obligation rather than a passion. And, you know, I had a hard time leaving the sport. There were so many justifications. I was like, oh, well, everyone's crazy, yeah. you know, or whatever. And like specific, I had vendettas against specific people and whatever it was. But mm-hmm. I think now, like, you know, I never was going to go to the Olympics. I never thought I was going to go to the Olympics. Yeah. But I think that like when you're in that sport, it is your life. Yeah. It is everything you do. So when talking about the Huffington Post article, so originally I wrote that for my college newspaper. Okay. And it was called Get Your Teeth Checked. And at the time, I was a junior at Barnard College. Mm-hmm. And the end of my freshman year is when I came to terms with my bulimia. And so I like went home for spring break, purged 8 times in one day, and was like, whoa, wow. That's not normal, you know?
Yeah.
And it was only because I was taken out of that original context that I was able to be like, whoa, like other people go into the dining hall and know how to feed themselves. Other people mm-hmm. like don't have this like sort of like childhood sports trauma, mm-hmm. you know? Like,
yeah.
And so I went into eating disorder recovery, and so I guess I was about a year and a half into recovery when I was asked to write this piece. And I wrote it, like, it was like one of those things where it was like, I woke up in the middle of the night and just like, ding, 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 ding. I published it in the Columbia University Spectator as an op-ed. It was super well received, and it was the first time that I was seen as a writer. And it was interesting because I didn't think of myself as a writer. I was like, they're like, oh, you're that writer. And I was like, yeah. I wrote one piece.
Yeah.
Slow down. But it was the first time that I was recognized as something other than a figure skater, right?
Yeah.
And so it's interesting now to look back and understand that that piece was the beginning of my career, right? Or mm-hmm. sort of like my artistic passion that existed outside of ice skating.
Yeah.
But also when I read that piece now, I understand that the context that's missing is ice skating. Mm. Like the hook of the piece is when I tell my mom that I was bulimic and her saying, well, get your teeth checked. Which is a shocking hook,
yeah,
right? Like,
right. Yeah.
I used it because it was hot to the touch, right?
Right,
like,
yeah.
Now when I, like, write something, I write what feels hot to the touch. That is the thing that I pursue.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, this is something that I was chewing on over and over and over again. And if you read the essay now, it's me trying to reconcile what happened and make sure that I'm okay, right? Like, it's
yeah.
like, and now my mom and I are fine, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a very, like, beginner writer instinct. To, like, put a bow on it and be like, here's this really challenging thing. Here's what I think about it. And now we're good, you know?
Yeah.
And now when I look back on, I mean, also at the time, like, my mom and I couldn't be in the same room together,
right.
you know?
Wow.
And so part of that was, like, wishful thinking.
Like, putting your what you wanted to be the future as that bow.
Exactly.
Oh, I can relate to that so much.
Yeah. yeah. And so then 6 months later, it got picked up nationally because mm-hmm. New York Post, like, waited till Eating Disorder Awareness Week to, like, be like, Dr. Drew's daughter writes about her anorexia.
Yeah.
And I found out about it in a tweet. And then within 24 hours, I was, like, on CNN and Extra, Entertainment Tonight. And then a week later, I was on The View being interviewed by Barbara Walters.
Wow.
And so I learned a lot of lessons fast.
Yeah.
I was 21, and I was learning, like, one, like, that I was a writer.
Uh-huh.
And then 6 months later, like, what my proximity to my father's platform meant. If I watch those videos now, I look like a senator's wife, you know, like I'm like airbrushed and like I literally, when I found out that I was going national, called my hairdresser. I was like, I had like bleached out yellow with like dark roots. And I was like, I can't go on TV like this. Like my ice skating came.
Yes. Oh yeah. my God. Yes. Yeah. It's like that pressure that you put on yourself.
Yes.
And then you were like, I have to be perfect.
Yes.
I have to live up to this image that I've created for myself.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Like I have to get my nails done. I have to do my hair. Like if I want people to take me seriously, I have to look a specific way.
Yeah.
And it goes to like ice skating where it's like, if you're 5 pounds overweight, or if your dress is ugly, or
you
if
are
you're,
judged on
you're
that.
Literally grown ass adults judging children about what they're wearing in tiny leotards, you know, and you literally think about those details.
Up. Like you literally could not form a more judgmental upbringing for any child.
Yeah. Well, it's like I really was when I first got, or I think it was like the summer after high school into college. Toddlers and Tiaras was a big thing.
Oh.
And I was obsessed with Honey Boo Boo Child.
Yes.
I remember
this
that.
Was a big phase for you.
And I see now it's like I saw our childhood, like granted, like there is a certain talent in pageantry, but also like ice skating was pageantry with actual like athleticism.
Yes.
And so like, you know, like Ice Princess or what, or Blaze of Glory, all yeah. those movies are not accurate. I, Tanya, is the closest.
The closest. Yeah.
Like the mom with True. The parrot.
Oh my yeah. God.
That it is was, an yeah. ice skating mom.
That yeah. was the truest depiction of the figure skating world I've ever seen.
Yeah.
In media.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that there's sort of like an in-group, out-group, right? Yeah. Like when you're in it, you yeah. understand that like Ice Princess is the fantasy, I, Tanya, is the reality.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I yeah. can, wow. This is why you're an acclaimed writer.
The word, yeah.
You just explained it just so well. Right on point.
Well, I you know, it's hard too, because like, I think that like most people who leave, like there's the people who like stay in figure mm-hmm. skating and they yeah. coach and that's like mm-hmm. their entire life. And you know, they'll do Disney on Ice or they'll, tour and they'll do like cruise ships or they'll like do mm-hmm. shows in Europe or whatever. And then they come back and coach. Right. So they're like in that world.
That's their whole life.
And then there's those of us who like
made it out.
We made it out.
Yeah. That's what we talked about earlier.
Yeah. You make it out and then you don't know how to translate that experience. Like obviously like your career makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
Like, because you're using those skills that you learned in figure skating at a heightened platform. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, mm-hmm. it makes perfect sense.
Thank
you know?
You.
Like,
thank you.
Yeah. Cause you're, I mean, you like as a figure skater, like you were very detail oriented. Like you yeah. were meticulous. And so like to see your empire build, like makes complete sense to me.
Thank yeah. you.
You know,
that means a lot. I feel like I have imposter syndrome a lot where I'm like, no, like I haven't done anything, you know, but it really does mean a lot. And especially for the three of us, I think we've seen each other on our journeys, maybe from afar, but yeah. like we've seen the yeah. growth. So yeah. it's so cool to see all of us really coming out of like a place that we weren't happy in, yeah. you know, at the end of the
yeah.
day.
Yeah. Well, for context, Trail and I.
Yes, we need to talk about this.
Yeah, so, well, this is something we need to bring up.
Okay. This is a whole
the tattoo.
Era.
Show them the tattoo.
This is a whole era.
So back in 2006?
I don't remember.
The Los Angeles Ice Theaters did Muppets on Ice. And I was cast as Miss Piggy, and Trail was Kermit. Now, Rachel Trail at 8 years... No, you were probably younger, like 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Was just like this little tiny, like, spindly
thing.
Yeah,
like
thing.
A stick figure.
And I was like a chompy, like... brassy broad as I am today. And we literally were wearing mascot heads, like literally baseball helmets covered in foam core with like
so huge,
giant like yeah. Disneyland mascot heads.
Insane.
Like you go to Times Square and you see knockoff Mickey Mouse, like that is what yes. we were wearing while ice skating. And I would literally pick up Rachel and just spin in circles and her legs would be like, you know, like it was the perfect dynamic. Now, obviously, I carry that brand forever. Obviously, I'm still living on that high.
I love that you've embraced it, though.
I love Miss Piggy, but I think, too, like, Danelle Cole, like, under... Mm-hmm. She saw something... She saw an artistry in me that I don't think my school saw. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, I went to a really intense, like, K-12 college prep school where it was, like, math and science and, like, ice theater... And ice skating, obviously ice skating is a super intense sport, and ice theater for me originally was like really fun.
Yeah.
You know? And like that was the first time that like I was cast in a role that I was perfect for. You
right,
know?
Right, right, right.
And then also like my first email address was MIZPiggy111. I told my mom I wanted Miss Piggy 1111. And she came back with Ms. Piggy 111. So aww. that's 2005 in a nutshell. But like you guys were like present in sort of the era that I'm discussing in
yes.
that piece, right?
Yeah,
and so
absolutely.
I think it's interesting to have conversations with people from childhood because yeah. I know sort of like the feeling of my childhood, but often when I talk to people from childhood, they have more specific memories of like witnessing my mom say something to me and it traumatizing them. And then I'm like,
no, I don't think.
I mean, trauma maybe is a big word, but like being memorable at least.
Yeah.
Totally.
Well, I think that's another just crazy psychological like thing that we remember such specific things and who even knows if they're right, you know? Mm-hmm. Like yeah. our memory is 50-50. There are studies about how our memory is like 50% accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's so interesting when you're talking about us dunking our faces. That sounds like a pretty memorable thing. Yeah. Yet I literally don't remember it at all. And then
wait,
I have other memories.
What is our age difference?
I think 3 years.
Okay, because I was 17 at that point. So maybe
I was 14. I hope I can remember shit at 14. Like, come on.
Yeah, but I don't think any of us wanted to be there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
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 Well, I think this is a perfect segue into, like, talking about how you're doing now versus before the article came out versus when the article came out, like, when it comes to how you view your body mm-hmm. and your self-acceptance. Radical self-acceptance is a huge theme mm-hmm. of our podcast, and we just wanted to get, like, a little timeline of, like, how that's changed over the years.
It's interesting because I'm newly sober, so I'm actually 7 months sober today.
Oh my god, congrats. Cheers! Liquid Death, sponsor us.
It's been interesting because, obviously, I started a newsletter called Newly Sober on Substack, and so I've been documenting sort of early sobriety.
Cool.
But, like, I am not new to recovery, right? Like,
right, yeah.
I think this conversation is a testament to that. And so when I first moved to New York in 2011, I went to Barnard College, and I remember, like, comparing my body to everybody I passed. Mm-hmm. Like, I was ranking, like, who was bigger than me, who was smaller than me, and if I was the smallest person in the room, I won, you know?
Yep.
And, like,
yep.
Wow. That mental gymnastics was so, it was my entire life. Mm-hmm. Like, wow. You know,
almost like those thoughts consume you to an extent where you're like, I legit can't think about anything else except the comparisons between my body and everyone around me.
Which is so interesting because there's not a limit on how many hot people, skinny people, fat people there can be. Like just because someone else is skinny doesn't make you not skinny. Yeah. Or, like, just because someone's hot doesn't make you not hot, you know?
I understand that, but I don't know if it's because of the figure skating competitive background or what it is, but it's almost like that doesn't even matter. When I am in that mindset, it doesn't matter what other people, like, it's just that I want to put myself down, or my emotions want to, like, hold me down in that comparison. But
yeah,
I mean, I think it absolutely has to do with ice skating because like all your friends are also your competitors.
Yeah.
And so it's like, even if you have, like, a strong emotional bond with someone, usually, like, my strongest bonds were with people that I didn't compete against. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Like Kiana McLaughlin, Rachel Trail, all these people. And then the people who I was competing with, inevitably it got to a point where, like, they had the whole ring shun me or whatever it was, you know? And
Whoa.
It's like, oh, yeah, that happened.
that happened to me too.
Yeah. Right. And it's like, then you're haunted by that.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
And I mean, for me, it was like, I took that as license to, like, be like, I'm out of the sport. Bye. Deuces, you know? But also at the same time, like, I'm sad that I allowed someone to have that power over me. You know what I mean? Like, and also you're 17 and that's your whole world, and I can go down that rabbit hole. But I do think it has to do with ice skating, but I also think that that's how people socialize as what female feel. Like, it's not, it's hype. Like, we're almost like the steroided version of that, but, like, we're not alone in that sort of, like, comparison model. And especially with the proliferation of social media and images, right? Like, so many people are trying to literally emulate what they see versus, like, creating a version of what they see in a distinct manner, right? And, like, you know, and I think this has to do with, like, sort of, like, the proliferation and sort of, like, mass acceptance of, like, plastic surgery and, like, like, the Instagram face is a thing. Like, Gia Tolentino wrote a piece about that, and you know, it's the Kardashians or whoever you idolize, whether it's Bella Hadid or Kim Kardashian or Kylie Jenner, like, you can literally emulate wear her face, and then by the time that's no longer lucrative for that person, they're going to change that aesthetic.
Yeah.
So you're chasing that thing, right?
Yeah.
But I digress. Back to the original question. So when I first got to college, I was really struggling. Like, it was all I could think about. I was, like, starting to binge and purge more because I would go to the dining hall, but I didn't know how to feed myself. And I'd, like, look around and be like, oh, they know how to eat normal amounts. You know, like, I only know, like, what my nutritionist told me to eat, you know?
Yeah.
Which was already disordered. And so then I started binging pints of ice cream. I remember I went to the local Morton Williams market and bought 2 pints of ice cream. And the person checked me out. They were like, would you like 2 spoons? And I was like, no, thank you. And I literally walked out of Morton Williams, ripped off the plastic on both, and dug my teeth in both of them. And then that's when I was like, whoa. this isn't, like, I was offered two spoons, expecting at least two people, and here I am using my teeth as spoons, you know, like, this is problematic. And so I think, like, sort of the eating strategies that had developed through ice skating were no longer serving me, right? And so then I had my bottom and came to terms with my eating disorder probably spring of 2012. I started playing rugby. Like, I just, like, started doing everything that no one expected, right? Yeah. Like, I was done being, like, the ice princess. Mm. Like, that's when I first, you know, fucking pierced my nose. That's when I, like, dyed my hair red.
Hell yeah.
And then I got it, like, professional. My mom was like, if you're going to do it, you have to do it professionally done. So I got it professionally done. And then I was in my room and I got, like, bleach and just, like, did chunks under it and, like, put, it was so bad.
It was like a rebellion.
It was because I didn't do it as a teen, right? And so fall of 2013 is when I wrote the piece. So I had just turned 21. Granted, I was, like, drinking that whole time. Like, as soon as I got to college, I was, like, binge drinking. Like, I've never...
That happens.
Yeah. Like, my nickname was Barflina because I would either blackout or vomit every time I drank.
Damn, girl.
Yeah. Like, I was looking back, and we'll get into this when I talk about sobriety, but, like, I was like, I'm not an alcoholic. And then I, like, started going through the memories. I was like, oh, I've... yeah. I was like, I've never been moderate in my life. And so, so I'm, like, binge drinking through that. And then, you know, the article, I figure out I'm a writer. And then, you know, I have, like, this sort of national exposure. And then I kind of snap back into sort of that, like, perfectionistic, like, my family is fine. Yep. Like, don't worry about it. Yep. Like, my mother and I are working on a relationship, but we're so much better than where we were before. And so then I got really depressed because people in my college were coming up to me and being like, you're so brave.
Right.
And I was like, none of this shit I'm doing is brave. Like, if I was actually being brave, I would have shown up on TV with my bleached out roots. You know, like, if I was being brave, I would have been like, yeah, my mom's a bitch. You know?
But also, like, you just talking about it to begin with is brave.
Yeah.
Like, I want you to take credit for that. I think at 19 years old, standing up and writing an article like what you wrote and going on national television talking about it, I get that, you know, you made it sound like a happy ending, but I really want you to recognize like that is a huge accomplishment.
Thank you.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. I appreciate that. I mean, obviously we're all harshest on ourselves, right?
Like, yeah,
I'm sure we all struggle with perfectionism here.
Yeah.
Well, so then afterwards it kind of felt like I was pigeonholed. Like, suddenly I became eating disorder girl, and it was like, oh, this is something that I literally recognized a year and a half ago, you know? And so, you know, influx of messages, influx of sort of like, I became an authority on this thing. Right. And it was like kind of imposter syndrome where it was like, yeah, I have an eating disorder and I'm in recovery and I'm doing therapy, but also at the same time, like, that isn't all that I am. And so that's when I, like, that summer I did a comedy program at Second City. And so I was like, I'm comedy girl. Like, let's comedy. Like, I want to make people laugh. You know? So it was like direct opposite.
Right.
And when I was at Second City, I ended up writing this super dark sketch about eating disorders.
Really?
Yeah. I want to find it again because it was like, basically, it was just like a super dark thing, but I was trying to figure out how to, like, do something different, you know?
Yeah.
And then so throughout college, my senior year, I started writing pieces about, like, weight-based stigma and body positivity. And, you know, 2012, 2013 is, like, when body positivity was, like, the thing. Like, that was, like, cutting edge. I am so thankful for body positivity because, like, I needed sort of the model of, like, the positive framework to sort of, like, eclipse the, like, constant monologue of, like, body checking and comparison and, like, all that. But really what I was pitching was, like, body neutrality. And people are like, what is your secret? And I'm like, look in the mirror and remain neutral. Like, no comments whatsoever, right? Yeah. And so at the same time, I'm pitching body neutrality, but also I'm, like, doing intuitive eating and, like, binge eating. And, you know, I needed that reactionary eating.
Yeah. Right?
From so restrictive to, like, over-consuming.
Right.
Again, I don't know how to moderate at all. And so then after college, I went to Second City and did the conservatory, and, like, you know, that was its own nerve-wracking experience just because, like, improv is probably the most vulnerable thing you can possibly do, which is, like, literally going up on a stage, not having a plan, and then just, like, making shit up and having people laugh.
Right,
like,
yeah.
You know, like, what the fuck? I'm a writer. I love to edit myself.
Yeah. You know? That, like, gives me anxiety just thinking about, like, this live performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you're literally making shit up on the fly.
Right.
And wow. I'm 23 and, you know, like, I'm trying to not be eating disorder girl, and I'm getting calls that they're like, Entertainment Tonight wants you to comment on this one thing that happened in regards to eating disorders or whatever. And I'm just like, like, I don't know if I want that. And so I ended up applying to graduate school, came back to New York, and pursued my MFA in nonfiction creative writing. And that's, like, when I think I started kind of getting back aligned with my purpose, right? Like, as a writer, like, you know, I was able to be in this container of, like, brilliant writers, brilliant mentors, like, really studying my craft, but also imposter syndrome to, like, the 50th mm-hmm. degree, right? Like, yeah. At this point, like, I'm not struggling so much with body image, right? Like, I think around my therapist once told me that, like, you should expect, because I remember saying to her, I was like, am I always going to feel this way? Like, because I remember being like, I walk down the street and I see my reflection and I fucking hate myself and I'm just tired of feeling that way. Like, and I have this specific memory of, like, being like, you're a piece of shit. Like, you woke up late, like, you're so fat and ugly and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden I, like, looked up and I was like, I'm at Columbia, you know? And I was like, how can I actually accept where I am versus being caught in this mental loop of, like, what a piece of shit I am, you know? And that was, like, a really clarifying moment to me. And I think it, like, probably preceded when I was like, am I always going to feel this way?
Right.
And my therapist said, like, you should expect to, like, you should give yourself the length of your eating disorder to sort of get to a like, a neutral state.
Oh, that's actually really interesting because I feel like we don't take the time or we don't give ourselves the patience to actually heal in that regard. Mm-hmm. You know, we expect it to be like, oh, I've had this trauma for the past 20 years, but I should be over it in a month.
Yeah.
I should be over it in 2 months. No. Yeah. I've been doing the work. Why am I not out of this already? Yeah.
No.
Or why am I slipping back in?
It's a roller coaster, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And so for me, I was symptomatic in my eating disorder from, like, 12 to 19. So, like, 7 years.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I guess I'm, like, 10 years out. I'm 29.
Woo.
Cheers to that.
Yes.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'm at this stage now where, like, when it comes to my body image, like, I love myself. Like, I am not worried about that. Like, those thoughts don't happen anymore, right? Because literally, like, purposefully was in therapy, like, did group therapy. Like, I was in therapy with that therapist for 10 years, right?
Wow.
We're like, we're working on this specific goal. And, like, I think the thing about eating disorders and the way that we treat eating disorders in this country is very much like, you're anorexic and you dip below your BMI and we put you in a, like, institution, and then they get you of weight and they give you another meal plan, which is just sort of a recapitulation of your control issues, but it's healthier. And then we send you on your way, right? When really eating disorders are like, what's the initial trauma? What is your family of origin like? What is your, you know, what is the family structure like? How do you communicate? Were you able to express feeling in that space, right? Like, and thinking specifically, like, about bulimia, like, something that really stays with me is, like, when you're vomiting, your mouth is in the same position as screaming.
Wow.
And so, like, you're expressing the same emotion, but in a muted fashion, right? So, like, if you're feeling anxious or angry, like, you vomit, right? Because that's a way to self-regulate.
Right.
And, like, literally when you vomit, and this is not, maybe I should say trigger warning vomit, but, you know, the dopamine release is, like, you get a high off of
really?
It. Like, you literally feel better. And that isn't to say, don't start.
Yeah.
Don't start. It fucks up your esophagus. I should know. And your teeth and your everything.
Anorexia and bulimia are the two most deadly mental health issues compared to all other mental health issues because of the recovery rate is, like, so low.
Well, I think part of that has to do with the fact that, like, the way that we treat eating disorders is very symptomatic of the disorder itself, right? It's like a recapitulation of the issue.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, let's get you away. Mm. Let's, like, get you eating some carbs, but healthy carbs, you know?
And that doesn't help because your mind is already in such a place where you're, like,
obsessive over all these different things that can contribute to your weight.
Yeah, and I was really lucky in that I, like, found a therapist who, like, her praxis was, like, very based in feminism and very much, like,
I love that.
Talk therapy and, like, she never gave me a meal plan. She never talked about my weight. She never talked about my diet and exercise regime, right? And like coming out of ice skating, I needed that.
Yeah.
Because like I was trained to lose weight for competition, and then after competition, I would binge eat everything, you know? And it's like that was routine. That's what everyone was doing, right?
Yeah.
And so now 10 years out, like I actually do practice body positivity. But I think that as a mode of recovery, body neutrality gets you to body positivity, which is, like, I think a more nuanced message. But then, too, like, once I got to, like, sort of treating my eating disorder, then it was like, oh, we've been smoking weed every day for the past 5 years. Like, maybe, like, we have addiction and alcoholism. So it's almost like the Pandora's box got reopened, right? And so coming into sobriety 6 months ago, you know, I wasn't a stranger to recovery, right? And so I was really thankful for the 10 years of eating disorder recovery, because like I knew sort of what I needed to do, right? Like I understood the framework with which I was going to operate within, but it was just a new problem, you know? Yeah.
Do you feel like all of those addictions or even these experiences that you've had, I almost think of them as like dominoes, where once one starts to, you know, eat away at you, it's all of a sudden like they're all very intertwined.
Eating, cutting, using.
Yeah.
The trifecta. I mean, I was never a cutter, but I think that like self-harm, like I think eating disorders are a form of self-harm. I think that like drinking and drug use can be a form of self-harm.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure that if like in 10 years I'll be like, yeah, actually I was doing this, which was self-harm, or like, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's a lifelong process. And I think specifically, like, if I look back on like 2013 in that piece, like what feels like clarifying to me is like ice skating is missing in that context. And like, you know, divorced of that context, my mom looks like an absolute sadist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, my mom was really mild. Like, she was one of the good, in my eyes, one of the good moms.
And it was so normalized that we didn't even, like, I feel like when we were growing up, it was normal to see moms or parents yelling at their children. Like,
hitting them.
Literally, physically hitting them. And that was normal. I remember another mom came up to me and threw coins at my forehead and a guard, like the thing that you put on your skating blade, threw a guard at my forehead while I was on the ice. My coach,
Wendy,
came up and was like, what is happening right here? Like, there was so much abuse that it felt normal. Like, it's a crazy world. We said this before we started recording, but figure skating is a cult.
Figure skating. I mean, that's why we were literally comrades in arms.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, I mean, first of all, every day it was like I came in, they're like, you gain weight behind your thighs and under your chin. Like, I noticed you gained weight, right? Like, it was a constant assessment of like where your body was.
Constant.
And like, moms were bullying.
So, I mean, I have a very distinct memory of this one mom being like, my daughter weighs blah, blah, blah. How much do you weigh? And then, like, later that year at LA Open, I had bombed or whatever, and her daughter had gotten third place. And I was walking out of Pickwick, and she has, like, kind of parked herself in front of those final doors. And I was like, oh, God, I don't want... Like, she's the crazy, like, crazy facelift with thick scars, like, face... Like,
forehead
tight as a drum, you know? Like, literally, like, haunts my nightmares. Let's call her Mother Monster. And... She, like, I roll up to her with my, like, you know, like, Roxy skating, like, suitcase with my like, that smells like feet or whatever. And she's like, what a shame, what happened out there, what a shame. And I was like, yeah, and then she literally puts her hand on my cheek and goes, well, at least you're still pretty. And then walked away.
Oh, my God.
I actually think this is the same person that threw the guard
at me.
I'm sure it is.
It has to be.
Oh, my God.
Like, this is insane. And it was, like, a true depiction of, like, a Disney villain. Like, when
Ursula.
Like, literally, like, we would, like, walk.
I know exactly who you guys are talking about, and I think Ursula is the best comparison. But, yeah, it's so interesting thinking back, because...
Yes.
Even there were times where my mom could have been deemed as like the crazy one.
Yeah.
But I also think it's just in that environment too. It brought that out in all of them. Like, our coaches would also act like our moms too, in a sense, and say that we had gained weight or like this or that, or like, you can't have any sugar. Like, there were some coaches that took on a mother role as well. And it just all these mostly women getting together, just like stirring around, like in the least healthy way, because it was so competitive yeah. and it was so cutthroat and tearing other women down, not very supportive at all.
Yeah.
It was insane.
I remember the first time my coach, one of my coaches, picked apart like my physical appearance. I was 8 years old,
oh
and he said,
God.
You need to lose 10 pounds. You need to get your ears stapled back. You need to get your teeth fixed because no man will ever love you. And if you land the next mm-hmm. double axel, maybe you could be my sex slave.
yeah. Insane.
Yeah.
In fucking
like
insane.
And I thought that was normal. Like, I genuinely yeah. was like, okay.
Okay, but more...
Didn't tell my mom or dad because I was scared.
First of all, I just want to thank you for saying that out loud
yeah.
because there's so many people who are in this sport and, like, I've been waiting for ice skating to blow up like gymnastics.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm surprised it hasn't,
yeah.
like, honestly.
Because there's such a... There's an investment in the Ice Princess persona,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
both in the sport and out
yeah.
it. And so it's almost like this, like, Stockholm syndrome
yeah.
of, like, we don't talk about it. Like,
yeah.
the culture of silence, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
something I kept saying in 2013 was, like, I don't have to suffer in silence anymore,
yes.
right? Like,
yeah.
absolutely. And so, like, silence is a premium in that sport, right? Like, but also you're 8 years old.
Eight
yeah.
years old. And then think about how, like, when you're getting told that at... in any of our adolescence, it's like, what do you do as you go through puberty? And then
yeah.
it gets just worse as
yeah.
anyone, as any human being gets, you know, you get in your head, but I feel like through those experiences, it was so deeply ingrained in me that I am not enough.
Yes.
I will
yeah.
not be enough. I have to change myself to like
mm-hmm.
be enough. And
yeah.
I have to prove myself if I
yeah.
land the double axel. Like, it's all these like
wow.
ifs and ands
mm-hmm.
and like you have to work for it and you have to change yourself and you have to be this image of perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you talked about that image of perfection in a similar way when you started your writing career.
Yeah.
And I feel like I can really relate to that with my YouTube life
yeah.
because it was the same thing where it was
yeah.
like all of a sudden I had this platform that I had somehow created and
yeah.
I have to like, I snapped back into that figure skating mindset of like, I have to be this perfect girl and hold up the products and smile and like
yeah.
whatever. And it created this huge separation
yeah.
where
yeah.
I felt like the person I presented myself as online, not intentionally, but it wasn't, no longer was it really me.
Yeah.
And it's been very recent that I've had, it was a hard realization to come to, but I really admire everything you've done to stay true to like the person that Paulina is. And now like the fact that we can sit here and have this conversation,
I mean,
is incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It's so healing, right?
It's so healing.
And I think too, like you two are in my Artist Way group right now. And
yes.
like, you know, I think that like Artist Way was such a tool for me.
Absolutely.
In terms of figuring out what my true purpose is and who I actually am and how
yeah.
I want to live, right?
That's how we found this.
Yeah, that's literally how
we've talked
about this
in our first
entire podcast
yeah.
in the
yeah.
last 3 weeks. We're on
yeah.
week six of our Artist
yeah.
Way cohort.
Yeah.
And we love it. It's such an interesting way to look at creativity. And I think
yeah.
with you leading the group, it has given us a community and a sense
yeah.
of belonging and guidance
yeah.
in this process, which has been so incredible. But
yeah.
we actually talked about the Artist Way a little bit in our intro.
Amazing.
We do not shut the fuck up.
Yeah, we constantly talk about, like, literally just
it's like
it
my
anyone.
It's a core part of my personality at this point. It's
I mean,
really
same.
Sad.
It's literally well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like I plan on doing it like at least every January every year, you know, like
awesome. Well, I think we have one final theme that we want to close out on. You had mentioned or talked about earlier maybe off camera that since you've become sober, you've moved back to LA and you're staying with your family.
Yeah.
I wonder how that whole new situation has impacted this whole recovery aspect and if it's put your recovery at risk or it's been helpful. Like, how do you feel about the whole situation?
I'm excited about this question. Okay, so when I first left home, I was fucking pissed. You know, like I was
yeah.
taken out of my context and I was like, what the fuck did I just experience for the last 18 years, right?
Yeah.
Like, I had this beautiful love of ice skating, and then it became this unyielding, toxic thing, and it became an instrument of my destruction, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't Paulina. I was Paulina the ice skater,
mm-hmm.
right?
It was your identity. It was my
yeah.
identity. It was
right.
our identity.
It was
yeah.
our identity, right? And so I was angry as shit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my mom, you know, is imperfect. My mom is her own woman. She is like...
yeah.
She is a weird ass lady and like that I love her for that now, right? But
yeah.
also at the same time, like I don't think that she was emotionally equipped for my anger.
Mm.
And so I kind of had to come to terms with like, oh, I can't change her, right? Like,
yeah.
Even if I want to, she's never going to be, like, the perfect mom that I want, right? And even if I had the dream mom, I'd be pissed off, right? Like,
right.
I think there just comes a point when you, like, you push against your parents. Like, that is part of, like, psychological evolution. Like, you have to sort of, like, push in order to, like, find yourself, and then you come back to the nest, right?
Yes.
Eating disorder recovery, like, they, like, went to therapy with me a few times or whatever, but I think that, like, parenting myself allowed me to sort of recognize that, like, my mom was doing her best, right? She was always doing her best. She was a bikini model in the 80s, married my dad, and then had, like, a figure skater. And so she was just producing me in the way that she would produce a bikini show. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I think in this leg of recovery, I wrote this book with my dad. And I was calling it the consent book I didn't consent to for a while. because my dad was like, we sold the consent book today. And I was like, what consent book? You know? And then at first I was like really resentful and was smoking a shit ton of weed and like drinking and boozing and whatever. And I was 3 months out of my MFA program. Like who else is like handed a book deal? Right. And like, I was super resentful. Now I'm super grateful, but I wasn't always. And that's like super fucked up, you know? And now I can sort of see that it was just like, again, it was sort of that differentiation process, right? Where like my dad was putting a vote of confidence in me, but I hadn't done that sort of like distancing thing with him. I'd done it with my mom, hadn't done it with my dad. And so then I wrote a book with my dad. And through the promotion of that book, I started working with my parents. Having the book to talk about with my dad and sort of this performance stratum allowed us to have conversations that we hadn't had before. Okay. And so leading up to my bottom, I was spending more time with my parents and having like real authentic conversations. Something I admire about my dad is that like he views himself as like a resource and he'll go anywhere where people need him, right? And so like there's a way to judge that and be like, he does Fox News, fuck that, which is what I did for a long time. But also at the same time, like he's exactly who should be on Fox News because that landscape needs a voice like him, right? And so I'm in that moment, I sort of had to contend with this idea of like, well, what looks good versus where I need to go, right? And so I think it was another moment in which like having learned the 2013 experience of like the senator's wife, like I got to show up authentically in those spaces, right? And like talk about feminism on Megyn Kelly, you know? And like, she was like, I think you're the most woke person we've had. And I'm like, only Republicans use the word woke in 2022, you know? But still, but YouTube comments, they fucking hated it, you know? But at the same time, like people who like were open to what I had to say received it really well. And so I was both able to like, one, like build, have conversations with my dad that needed to happen prior, to kind of build my relationship with my parents, and my mom produces all my dad's stuff. So she was in the producer's chair.
I didn't know that.
Wow.
She was in the, she was like sort of in the background. And so it was kind of like a comfortable dynamic.
Right.
But now it wasn't about like my hair and my makeup or whatever. I buzzed my head on purpose for that shit so that no one could say anything, you know? And so I was able to show up in an authentic way and launch my career, you know? And then, you know, December 22nd, you know, my bottom is a whole other thing. But basically, I was driving from New York to New Orleans with my then fiance and we had run out of weed and he went into active withdrawal. And over the course of a 3-day drive, he became illogical, verbally combative and suicidal. Now I'm still, So I was able to call my parents and be like, I don't know what's happening. They're like, get home, come home, come home now. You know,
that gives me chills.
Yeah. It was fucked up. It was really bad. It was like the worst experience. But like, it's okay. I mean, I think now, now I feel grateful for it, right? Because I wouldn't be sober. I wouldn't be able to show up in this way. Like, I loved smoking weed. I loved smoking weed, but also at the same time, like, I wasn't getting high anymore. Like, I was staying in a relationship that didn't serve me. I was paying for everything. Like, I got a book advance October. It was gone by December because I was trying to save a failing relationship, right? And so once I got sober, I had to actually, again, it was like this level up, right? Where it was like, oh, I understood that I had my parents' support. So I was able to call them and they were like, get to an airport immediately, you know, and get home. And I crash landed home and like that whole journey like was hard. And basically like, when I got to New Orleans, which the car ride is its own thing, and eventually I'll write about it and talk about it. But my then fiance told me, if I go to rehab, Paulina has to promise never to procreate. And that was like, because he was an antinatalist and it was a whole thing. It's just like, just to show that like, I was living in those circumstances for the past 2.5 years, right? Like, yeah. And because I was stoned every day, I stayed, right? And the minute that I stopped smoking, the first day of that drive, I couldn't stay anymore.
Wow.
You know, so I could actually hear my intuition. I could actually hear my own voice. And it was like, run.
They do say that marijuana like blocks your third eye so that you cannot listen to your intuition.
Wow.
Yeah, my energy healer told me that once.
That makes so much sense because literally had to smoke weed to stay in my relationship, right?
Yeah. Well, we really wanted to thank you for coming on
today.
I know.
Thank you so much. This was an incredible conversation. Yeah.
Thank you guys. Like, number one, I'm so proud of you both in terms of like where you are and who you are and what you're doing, but also it's been such an honor and privilege to like do Artist Way with you.
Aww.
No, but truly, I mean, like, who thought that like 10 years out or however long out, like, we would be sitting here having this conversation?
I was literally thinking the same thing. Like, it's crazy how life just takes you on these, you know, it's not linear. It's, you go down these little river paths and roadways, and it's cool that life has brought us back together. So thank you so much.
I love you both so dearly. And whenever you want to talk again, I'm here, because this
hell
has been
you have a lot to talk about. We should bring you on again for season.
Bush baby for life.
Bush baby for life.
I love it.
We definitely like to close out on a fun note.
Okay.
And so we wanted to ask you if you have any good hot takes on life.
Yeah, hot takes. You just say a hot take on life.
What is my hot take? Well, it's interesting to say this in front of Roxette, because she probably has more of a take on this, but like, I fucking love a skincare routine.
Ooh.
Like, I'm religious about washing my face and brushing my teeth every morning and night.
Okay, wow. I need to be more inspired by you on this.
Yeah,
me too. I fall asleep in my makeup every single night.
Really?
It's been since Artist Way, since the last 6 weeks that I started reading and writing in my morning pages and noticing that I'd be so upset at myself every day after I would literally fall asleep without brushing my teeth or doing my makeup or anything. So I've like started to do it now, and I love it. It's like surprising how much better my skin looks now that I'm actually taking care of it.
We love that. Well, it makes sense though, because I feel like you're probably having to like test products and sell things and all that. So
it's like work.
It is like work.
Yeah.
And for me, like, I've really like honed in on specific products that like really make me feel good, and like, but I'm going to give Brujita a plug on this, because they are a Latina-owned and run like organic face brand in LA. And they have a Hechizo serum that is... It's literally like 4 drops, and it's fucking like... I don't know what the fuck is in it, but it is so good. And like, literally, I look forward to putting that shit on my face twice a day.
Wow.
You gotta find products, and not even products, products that make you feel confident and that work for you.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing, is like, this any makeup routine, skincare routine, I'm finding that it's not about the product. Like, no product is gonna make me happy or build upon my confidence, but it's how it makes me feel.
Yes.
And how your routine makes you feel, and how you're taking care of yourself and prioritizing you.
Yes.
Like, that's what beauty is about now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a hot take.
Hell
Get Brujita Hechizo Serum.
Thanks again, Paulina.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. This was awesome.
Yeah.
You guys, I'm so proud of you.
Thanks.
We're proud of you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, that was enlightening.
That was such a good conversation. Yeah. Like, I just feel like she brought so much to the table.
Yeah.
She's incredible.
She's just
and
fucking
such an
awesome.
Inspiration.
She's so cool. I want to be her.
We'll link all of Paulina's socials down below as well, so you guys can find her and check out her other works that she's published, because she really is not only an incredible speaker, but an incredible writer and human.
Yeah. And her Instagram is Ms. Piggy. Let me spell it out here real quick. MIZPIGGY 111.
And we haven't even like talked about our own, but you guys can also follow Rachel at Rachel Tra.
Yes. Rachel, RCHELTRAA. And Roxette Arisa at RO, you can spell it.
RoxetteArisa. But yeah.
And our group. Our actual.
Oh my God! I forgot we also have a Bush Babies IG, guys.
Yeah.
We're really new to the podcast space.
Please definitely follow us, subscribe on YouTube and Instagram. And it is Bush Babies World. So Bush Babies, like this.
World. All right. Well, see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for watching. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube at Bush Babies World, as well as our personal accounts at Roxetteresa and at Rachel Traw. And make sure to join our Discord to be an official part of the BB community. Make sure to stay up to date with everything we have going on at www.bushbabiesworld.com.